And I believe I every week, because I just kind of pick up where I think I left off, and I've got to find a better way to mark my Bible. But I believe we're in Psalm 19 tonight. Nobody say anything, so I'll go with that. But the I've got to write things down better. But Psalm 19, verse 1. The heavens declare the glory of God, and the firmament shows His handiwork. Day unto day utter speech. In night unto night reveals knowledge. There is no speech, nor language, where their voice is not heard. Their line has gone out through all of the earth in the words to the end of the world. In them He has set a tabernacle for the sun, which is like a bridegroom coming out of his chamber and rejoices like a strong man, and it runs its race from the rising from one end of heaven and its circuit to the other end, and there is nothing hidden from its heat. Here in this really a wonderful psalm, the way that David writes it, but as he reveals, in a sense, on how God reveals Himself. And there's three ways in this psalm that God has this wonderful revelation of who He is and things about Himself. First of all, God just reveals Himself through nature in the first six verses. He reveals Himself through Scripture in about the next six. And in the last two, He reveals Himself through human experience. All of which, though, it is God speaking. You notice, I mean, the wonderful thing is here God just looks in for perhaps the most profound way that God speaks. It's just through the heavens. He says, the heavens declare, the firmament shows, day into day utters speech, night into night reveals knowledge. There is no speech or language where their voice is not heard. Here it is something where, as David writes, he says, existence itself, creation, reveals God's glory. It speaks of Him. Every day when the sun comes up, there's another speech, there's another utterance from God. There's another utterance of His power and His glory and His magnificence all about Him. In Romans chapter 1, Paul really brings out this same point when he says that God, the invisible things of God are revealed just through creation itself. I believe it's in chapter 1. You can go look at it. But it's there. But he says, even what we do not see of God, what we do not, the invisible things of God and of His character, it's clearly revealed in nature as to His power and of His glory. It doesn't maybe perhaps reveal aspects of His salvation, and we'll look at more later, but in the sense of just simply, first of all, stating God is. Boy, is He ever. When you just look at creation, it is something here. As David writes, he says, there is not a language. There is no speech or language where this voice is not heard. In other words, the first thing that God has just set in creation is simply every day, I am. I am. I exist. I am powerful. I am wonderful. I'm awesome. I'm glorious. I'm a genius. Who could even begin to think of creation? Of something as glorious as creation, as majestic, as overpowering, as awesome. You can't even measure it. Can't even dream, and all of the scientific things and genius of man trying to even measure God or His creation, what He has done, can't even do it. But it's something there that here David says God speaks, first of all, just through existence. Their line has gone out through the earth, and the words to the end of the world, and He has set them a tabernacle in the sun, which is like a bridegroom coming out of its chamber. He says every morning when the sun comes up, here it's just something there. It's just as if there's a wedding going on. Almost it's just, you go to a wedding and everyone is sitting around and waiting. And the thing that really ushers the beginning of a wedding is when the bridegroom, I mean, everybody comes in and sits down and moms and dads are seated. But the thing that starts it is when the groom comes out. Now they know the next thing is the bride is coming. And the wedding is started. But it's like God is just looking at creation. Anybody looking at creation ought to be, it's as if God is telling, I'm coming, and I love, and I'm powerful. Creation is not a painful thing. It's not a sorrowful thing. It's not a tragic thing. It's a majestically glorious, wonderful thing when you look at the world and you look at nature, particularly the more you go into just nature itself. When you get away from our cities and all the stuff we build and we pollute and we mess up. People, it's amazing. With all of our power and creation and wealth. It's amazing on how when everybody, when they get rich enough, what do they do with their money? They go where we've never built anything. Or there's this, that there's as least as possible of what man has done. We want to go to some island. You know, some place to where it's just paradise, where every morning the sun is there and the wind comes through and the waves are there and there's just creation. And I don't know too many people that when they can hardly wait to save up their money so they can go to Los Angeles and just spend a few days walking the streets and the wonderful evenings as the sun goes down. But it is something that we love creation. Well, it speaks of God. I believe that's why. But not only does creation speak so wonderfully of him and reveal him, but also his word. For the next thing he says is God reveals himself. Creation is a great revealer of God. But then he says in verse 7, the law of the Lord is perfect, converting the soul. The testimony of the Lord is sure, making wise the simple. The statutes of the Lord are right, rejoicing the heart. The commandment of the Lord is pure, enlightening the eyes. The fear of the Lord is clean, enduring forever. The judgments of the Lord are true and righteous altogether. More to be desired are they than gold, yea, than much fine gold, sweeter also than honey in the honeycomb. And here is David then writes, he says, God has given us creation to speak to us, but then he has given us his word. And there as he speaks to us, he just says, the law of the Lord is perfect. The law is so wonderful, it is so glorious, it is so complete. The law of the Lord, he says, is perfect and it converts the soul. Later on in the New Testament, we're told that the law is a schoolmaster to bring us to Christ. And the law in and of itself doesn't save anybody, but it brings us to a place of realizing that we're lost and we're hopeless. It's a schoolmaster. That's what the Bible says the law does. It brings us to a place, I need a Savior. I need somebody who can help me. When the Bible says, thou shalt not have no other gods before me, how many times do we? When it says there'll be no idols, no graven images, or how many times we find ourselves worshiping or seeking something from something other than God and relying and depending upon it. When the law of the Lord it reveals and says, thou shalt not kill, thou shalt not commit adultery, thou shalt not steal. And but here, when we begin really to find out the truth of the law and we realize that if somebody, as Jesus said, hates his brother, he's already committed murder. If a man looks at a woman with lust after in his heart, he's already committed adultery. That there is, we find ourselves coveting from our neighbor. And the next thing we know, we realize that we're stealing our own heart. We're wanting something that isn't ours. And that the law is not there that is something that is put there as a standard that by keeping it, in the sense that it saves me, the law drives me to a place of realizing I need a Savior. And but here is something where the law of the Lord, it is perfect, it converts the soul. The testimony of the Lord is sure, making wise the simple. You know, here the person who begins to study the Word and love the Word, meditate in the Word, they realize that the more we study, the more we know of it, that there's something there that it converts our own soul, and it makes wise. As we just look at the testimonies of God, the way that God works and the way that he moves, the testimonies of his power and of his existence, of his mercy, of his grace. Somebody who studies not just simply the law of God, but also the testimonies, his behavior in human history, and realize, look what God does. Men fail and God fixes all the time. He's fallen and God forgives. Constantly and realize, look at God's great testimony. And here he says, somebody who studies the testimonies of God makes wise the simple. You and I in our simple little finite minds, but the more that we not only study God's law, but we study his testimonies, the more we begin to realize there's great wisdom in it. You begin to have a guidance system to live by yourself and to guide other people and to have wisdom for them. The statutes of the Lord are right, rejoicing the heart. The standards and the things and the behavior that God sets out for us, the behavioral things, he says, these things are so right. They are so good. to realize on how that affects a society and a culture and just the things that God lays out. Here, live this way and walk this way and behave this way. The way that he establishes the statutes for a culture and a society. And that when somebody looks and realizes his laws and study his testimonies and study his statutes, and he says it's so wonderful. It rejoices the heart that there's a way to walk. There's a way to resolve things. There's a way to deal with things. The commandment of the Lord is pure, enlightening the eyes. Here is God lays out his commandments, his expectations upon people. There, the more that somebody knows what God requires of us, and how wonderful it is. Most of our trouble, I'm convinced, as Christians, and let alone in the world, is through ignorance. Things that we don't know of God's law or his testimony or his standards or his commandments. And then he says, the fear of the Lord is clean, enduring forever. And the word fear, we think of it as just to be afraid, but the word in the Bible, it definitely has that. It's to be feared. But he wants to be feared the way that I think a parent, a father wants to be feared. And that means when the Bible talks about the fearing God, it means to reverence with fear. It means to revere God so highly and to want to obey him so much as we would just reverence him. But the perimeters of a healthy reverence is fear. And that is, there's nothing to fear in God himself, but there is the healthy fear of crossing him. Just like a parent, hopefully, we would want to instill within our children a healthy fear, something that when they're obeying us, and that we're laying out, here's the expectations, here's the plan, here's the laws and the standards and the testimonies and the judgments. You live within these things, you'll be fine. But if you live outside of them, you better fear. When a parent says, here, you can play in the yard, and here's your toys, and here's this, but now here's the sidewalk, and there's the street. Don't go across this. That there, when somebody's in the yard, they love it, and oh, it's so wonderful to have somebody that leads and guides and watches over and protects. But as they get near the sidewalk, the reverence would turn into a sense of fear when there's some temptation or some attraction outside or to run and play in the street, that then something else would kick in, the healthy side of reverence, that fear that says, I don't know why he would say that. I don't understand cars yet. I'm just a little child. Maybe, and I don't understand I can get hurt. I don't understand I can, you know, the terrible things happen, but I just don't want to, even though I don't understand maybe even all the time why. I just know I want to fear him. And I want to fear crossing him. I want to fear the consequences of what could happen in disobedience. But here as he explains, he says that the fear of the Lord is such a clean thing. It endures forever. It never, when somebody has this good, healthy fear, there's a great enduring thing. The judgments of the Lord are true and righteous altogether. It's like, look at God at any aspect. What he thinks, what he feels, what he commands, what he expects, how he works. Look at God from any angle of his thought or his behavior and his mechanisms, and it's all perfect. It's all right. It's all wonderful. It enlightens the eyes, makes wise the simple, converts the soul. It endures forever. They're true and righteous altogether. And then David says, more to be desired are they than gold, yea, than much fine gold, sweeter also than honey than the honeycomb. Here he looks, and David looks there and he says, if you could just know of his law and of his testimonies and statutes and commandments, and have a fear of the Lord within your heart, he says, you get these things. This is more to be desired than gold. A lot of gold. A lot of pure gold is what he's saying. More to be desired are they than gold, yea, than much fine gold. And not only is it something that's rich, but then he goes, sweeter also than honey in the honeycomb. I mean, something there that it just seems so, money is power and honey is the sweet side of life in a sense. He says, this is more wonderful than all the power you can have and in all the sweetness that you could add to your human experience to make your life a wonderful, comfortable experience. And but to have them. And he says, and moreover, by them is your servant warned. And in keeping of them, there's great reward. here he looks there, he says, by these things I'm warned when I would tend to get astray, what can happen. They tell me the boundaries of what happened when I start to turn away, but they also tell me the rewards when I turn toward. They're looking there and realizing, I love these things. God, that you have given us your law, you've given us your word, you've given us your commandments, you've given us so much. And then he goes on into the human experience side on how it teaches us as well. We were taught in the revelation of God through nature. We're taught the revelation of God through his word. And then here in 19 verse 12, he says, who can understand his errors? Cleanse me from secret faults. Keep back your servant also from presumptuous sins. Let them not have dominion over me. Then I shall be blameless and I shall be innocent of great transgression. Let the words of my mouth and the meditation of my heart be acceptable in your sight, O Lord, my strength and my redeemer. And here he looks there and he says, I not only learn as I just get up and I see creation, and as it speaks of God's glory, as I have his word that's a lamp unto my feet and a light unto my path, and that as I hide his word, I don't sin against him, and I'm living by his word, it guides me. But then he goes on and he talks about not only I've got the creation and I've got his word to open up, but then I've got my own experience and human heart there when I look at my own failings and I look at my own struggles, I look at my own faults, and he turns, he says, God, cleanse me from them. Keep back your servant from presumptuous sins. Don't let them have dominion over me. He says, I want to be blameless. I want to be innocent of great transgression. And now he looks and he brings it right into his human experience. And he says, God, what I see in creation, what I see in your word, I want to experience it in my heart, in my thoughts, in the meditations of my mouth and of my heart. Chapter 20 says, may the Lord answer you in the day of trouble. May the name of the God of Jacob defend you. May he send you help from the sanctuary and strengthen you out of Zion. May he remember all of your offerings and accept your burnt sacrifice. May he grant you according to your heart's desire and fulfill all of your purposes. We will rejoice in your salvation in the name of our God. We will set up our banners. May the Lord fulfill all of your petitions. Now I know that the Lord saves his anointed. He will answer him from his holy heaven and with the saving strength of his right hand. Some trust in chariots and some in horses. We will remember the name of the Lord our God. They have bowed down and fallen, but we have risen and stand upright. Save, Lord, may the King answer us when we call. And here it's something where, of course, as long as there has been people, as long as there's been a society, all the war started essentially in the garden. Started spiritually there when the enemy came in and started war. War, first of all, between God and man and between man and devil, and all these things occurred. Then war between even a marriage. There Adam's blaming, Eve, it's the woman thou givest me, and Eve's blaming the serpent. I didn't do it, the devil did it. And don't blame me, and shoving it off, and war starts. Then they have children, one son kills another, and then around, I think it's Genesis 13 or 14, the first time in the Bible it's interesting that kings are mentioned in the plural, and then there's more than one king. It's also the same chapter in the Bible where wars are mentioned. All you need is more than one king, and you'll have wars. And when you've got wars, you've got armies, and you've got weapons, and you've got nations that begin to boast of their power and want to command fear over others, and empires rise and fall through all of history. But here is David as he's looking, of course, growing up in a world of war. He looks there and he tells somebody as he writes there, he says, may the Lord answer you in the day of trouble. May the name of God, the God of Jacob, defend you. May he help you, send you help from the sanctuary and strengthen you in Zion. May he remember all of your offerings, accept your burnt sacrifice. And here, David, he just gives the great answer for battles, the great answer for wars. You and I, we live in a world of wars. Wherever you go, there's wars. Wherever there, all you need is two people that are fallen, and there's wars of one level or another. All you need is society. And then next thing you know, you've got weapons and you've got ammunition and you've got the devil in there giving accusation to one another, and you've got confusion and you've got misunderstanding. And here is David writes, he says, you don't need horses to resolve wars. Some trust in horses. Some trust in chariots, he writes down. And he says, but we just remember the name of the Lord. And it's when somebody just learns this, the weapons of our warfare, they are not carnal. The Bible tells us, you and I as a Christian, our warfare are what God gives us, the great equipment to fight back the battles and the wars of life. It isn't horses and it isn't chariots. It isn't something where it makes us stronger than somebody else, but our strength is a greater thing than even that. And it's mercy and it's grace and it's kindness and it's gentleness. That's a power the world doesn't know of, but it's the power that reconciles and wins for the kingdom of heaven, the battles. I love it in John 13, when it tells us there about how Jesus, it says, having come from heaven, from his Father, and going, knowing he's going back to his own, with all power given unto him. I mean, here Jesus, he's got one last shot to do things. Knowing he's come from God, he's about to go back, and all power is given to him. Here with all this majesty, all this unbridled strength, the strength of eternity, the strength with which he created the worlds with. And here he is the next day about to go to the cross and die for the sins of the world, but there with the backdrop of knowing his power and knowing who he is and knowing where he's going and all of this given to him. And what does he do with it? What's his last great exhibition of power? It says that Jesus, he gets a basin and with his disciples, and he begins to wash their feet. And you look at this thing and you say, wait a minute, this is all power? This is what you do with strength? This is what you do with all the majesty of heaven? God says yes. If it's the power to heal, you see. It's the power to forgive. It's the power to restore. It's unlike the world's power that comes up when we, how big of an army can we get? How great we can be? How strong we can be? How powerful we can be? Here, Jesus, I know I want to give you a strength way beyond it. And David, here it's like he reflects on that. He says, let the Lord handle all the issues of your life, and may he remember your offerings. May he accept your burnt sacrifice. You and I, our business is to come and offer my heart, offer my life unto him. Remember the surrender. That's what a burnt sacrifice is. Here he says, you got battles there. You got days of trouble all around you. You need God to defend you. He says, I'll tell you where his help is going to come from. It's going to come from his sanctuary. And you want to know the key to his sanctuary? It's a burnt offering. You want to know how to open up heaven's doors and get the power of God in your side? Go just offer. Surrender yourself to him. Lay it down there. And he says, then may he grant you according to your heart's desire. Fulfill your purpose. And you will rejoice in your salvation. In the name of God will be your banner. May the Lord fulfill all your petitions. But it's a surrender life. Here David, he looks there and he says, it isn't horses, it isn't chariots. It's the name of the Lord our God. Chapter 21, he goes on, and the king shall have joy in your strength, O Lord, and in your salvation. How greatly shall he rejoice. You have given him his heart's desire. You have not withheld the request of his lips. For you meet him with blessings of goodness. You set a crown of pure gold upon his head. He asked life from you, and you gave it to him. Length of days forever and ever. His glory is great. In your salvation, honor and majesty you have placed upon him, for you have made him most blessed forever. You have made him exceedingly glad with your presence. For the king trusts in the Lord, and through the mercy of the Most High he shall not be moved. And here is David as he finds himself coming before the Lord. This is such a wonderful psalm. I think that here David finds himself there just reflecting. Something I think we do so little of. He's just looking at all God's done. Now, the kingdom wasn't done. The battles weren't all fought. The enemies hadn't ceased. The struggles in the land, I mean, there was still so much to be done. But here David found himself there looking there and realizing all that God had done in his life. all the things that God had done, the salvation that God had given to him, the strength that he had given to him, the way that God had just blessed him and had just responded so much to David. I think one of the things that one of the greatest tragedies that I think of our society and our culture is that we live in a world today where I don't believe a society has been more materially blessed than the 20th century America. What we have today, I mean, you even look back at what was around a generation ago, whether it's of wealth or of homes or of stuff. Just stuff, endless stuff, you know. But of course, everybody, there's always somebody that has more. And there's something that's tragic about a society that gets materialistic, because there's a spirit that gets in it, to me, of ingratitude. It never has enough, because, of course, those things never satisfy. But when somebody gets and grows up in that society, and whatever you got, it isn't enough. Whatever it is that you did, there's another battle, there's another thing. Well, yeah, I got this, but there's still this over here. But I think one of the most wonderful things in life, when a person begins to command their own soul to be grateful, begins to order it. Well, you selfish, egotistical, you know, prideful soul, don't talk to God that way. I think sometimes when David, oftentimes, he spoke to his own soul. It wouldn't just let it run at the mouth type of a thing. David, at times, when there's something wrong, he could rebuke himself. But I think that when somebody as well can look there and begin to turn to God and tell it how it ought to think. And David finds himself so grateful with God's blessing. He looks there and he says, God, you've given me a crown. You've given me a throne. You've given me so many blessings. And just to be grateful for them, it is such a wonderful thing. He then goes on in verse 7, he says, the king trusts in the Lord, and through his mercy, and through the mercy of the Most High, he shall not be moved. Your hand will find all of your enemies, and your right hand will find those who hate you. You shall make them as a fiery oven in the time of your anger. The Lord will swallow them up in his wrath. And the fire shall devour them. Their offspring you shall destroy from the earth, and their descendants from among the sons of men, for they have intended evil against you. They devised a plot which they are not able to perform. Therefore you will make them turn their back. You will make ready your arrows on your string towards their faces. Be exalted, O God, in your own strength. We will sing and praise your power. Here David, he still, as I said, he's got enemies. And he's got battles, and he's got trials, but there's two sides to his heart here, to me, that are so healthy here in this chapter. One is he's a very grateful man, and he sees all that God has entrusted to him and given him responsibility over and leadership over, and the kingdom that's under him. And then he turns around, and in the second part of the psalm, he gives great wisdom of the heart of a leader, I believe. Not only the heart of a leader towards God for all that is done, but the heart of a leader towards God or towards anyone else outside for what yet is not done, what is uncompleted, the battles that are out there. And he looks there as in verse 7, he says, the king trusts in the Lord, and through the mercy of the Most High, he shall not be moved. He looks there into me, when you and I, and whatever it is, that when we can take our own little worlds. And every one of us has a kingdom of some sort. You may be, a mother, and you just have a little child crawling around. There's your kingdom. And it rules over you, you think, or whatever. You've got a job, or you've got, a company where here's your vehicle and here's your responsibilities, or you own this or that, or you do whatever. But we all have something that God has given to us and trusted, wants us to be grateful for it in the first place, and then secondly, he wants us to turn around with it in the most responsible of ways, whatever it is, and to be able to trust in God to care for it, to oversee it. First, we're grateful for the job that he's given us, the responsibility, and then we turn and we say, Lord, I trust you. Through your mercy, I won't lose my kingdom. Through your mercy, that's what he says there when he says, I'll not be moved. I won't be kicked off my throne. through your mercy I'll stay here. Not because I'm powerful, not because I'm great, not because I have any great credentials to do what it is I'm given to do, but because I know the credential of your mercy. And I know that your hand, you know, you will fight your enemies. Your right hand will fight those who will find those who hate you, and you make them a fiery oven in time of your anger, and you'll swallow them up in your wrath. You will deal with all the things that are wrong. You'll solve them. You'll work your way through them. And to me, when somebody just knows they're a grateful person to God, their life is surrendered up, they walk in His presence, there's a great spirit of gratitude and appreciation that God's with them and He loves them and He's put a crown on their head and He's given them all the blessings of life around them. And then He looks at His responsibility and the battles that are involved in it and He turns to His Lord, in your mercy, you take care of this. You'll fix this. All I need to do is see I'm on your side, and when I'm on your side, anything that opposes you, though it appears to oppose me, its problem isn't me. It's you. You handle them. You'll be the one to go out there and you'll find them. You'll fight them. You'll swallow them up. You shall devour them. And